Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Way back in 2012, two nationally respected scholars, one from a nonpartisan think tank perceived to lean left, one from a nonpartisan think tank perceived to lean right, came together to assess the state of American politics. Despite decades of professional political neutrality, they felt compelled to be true to their conclusion. While neither party was blameless, congressional Republicans were more likely than their Democratic colleagues to be ideological extremists and more responsible for gridlock. 4 years later, they say the climate in Washington is even worse than it was. And among other things, they want the media to stop reporting as if the two parties were using the same tactics. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Thomas Mann is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and resident scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. His book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, was written with Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute and published in 2012. They've just updated and re-released the book in light of the current political climate. Tom, welcome to Think.
Delighted to be with you, Chris.
Since you use this term, extremism, where's the line between reasonable ideology and extremism?
I think it's whether or not your ideology is so strong that you refuse to believe your lying eyes. It's really an element of pragmatism. It isn't just ideological extremism, though. It really has to do with what you believe is sort of legitimate strategies for trying to achieve your policy objectives, whether or not you consider the opposition party a legitimate player in American democracy, whether you have any respect for the whole idea of facts, evidence, and science, and whether you value compromise as the framers of the U.S. Constitution did, and in designing our very complicated, checked and balanced political system. All of those elements go into making up whether a political party or candidate is extreme or not.
Your assessment is that the GOP is acting or trying to act in ways that resemble how the majority party behaves in a parliamentary democracy, in which one party at a time controls the legislature and installs its leader as prime minister. This kind of winner-take-all approach seems to work reasonably well in Australia and Japan and the UK. Why is it so toxic in a country set up to have checks and balances between powers?
Well, because the executive is a creature of the legislature. That is, it's majorities in the legislature that elect a prime minister. And so you have one team controlling both functions of government. In the American system, it's very easy and very common to have divided party government. Look back and in 2008, Barack Obama won a significant victory, and with him were elected majorities in the House and the Senate. We had a period of unified party government. Mind you, there's still lots of obstacles and veto points in the policy system, but at least the capacity for engaging in lawmaking and governing existed. In fact, for about 7 months of that first 2 years, Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate, which is enough to support cloture, which means ending filibusters and proceeding on. But since the 2010 election, the Republicans have controlled one or both houses of Congress, and they have followed in those years what their stance was in the first 2 years of the Obama administration. That is a automatic, vehement opposition to anything he proposes. If Obama proposed something that they had 2 years ago favored, they now had to oppose it because he was the enemy, and this was a serious game of political warfare. So it turns out our separated institutions with separate elections only work if both parties have some interest in governing and don't stand on principle and entirely. I mean, obviously, each has values, they have differences. All of this is true, but if the American public produces a divided government, if they act like a parliamentary opposition and just oppose, they can be a destructive force in our government and politics, unlike in a parliamentary system where they can oppose all they want. It has no governing significance.
When you and Norman Ornstein wrote the first edition, was there a single event that crystallized for you the extent to which what you call the politics of extremism had corrupted lawmaking in this country, or was it like just the preponderance of examples?
This has been building over a long period of years. It goes back, actually, in some ways, originates in the Goldwater movement in 1964, and he was defeated, but those who lost really continued to work, and by Ronald Reagan's presidency, they really came to the fore, and the so-called mainstream governing Republicans pretty much were pushed to the side. Now, ironically, Reagan turned out to be a pretty pragmatic president. He said government's the problem, not the solution, and he looked to cut taxes, but he also raised taxes when deficits got too high and changed his mind on the Soviet Union. He was not a pure ideologue, but over the next set of years, the Republican Party really drifted away from their traditions of Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower, even Richard Nixon, and became vehemently ideological and oppositional. Now, having said that, I think the there were two things that really had a bearing that struck us that this is not the same as it's been before. One was the inauguration day for Barack Obama in 2009. This has been now well reported in several books and long articles. At that time, on that day, Republicans made a decision, and the decision was to oppose everything he recommended, whatever he recommended, even though we were in a financial and economic crisis at the time. The idea was we're not going to have our hands over his policies because we want to be able to stand apart from them and criticize them. So they refused to play ball on the stimulus that was absolutely essential in avoiding a great recession. They denounced the financial arrangements for saving the global financial arrangements that their president, George W. Bush, had reluctantly taken with mostly Democratic support in Congress before he left office. So that was the first thing to realize that it was all oppositional and there was no hope. I mean, Obama campaigned on the notion that we are not a nation of red states and blue states. We are the United States. Well, that was nonsense. Maybe he believed it, but it just wasn't true, and it became less and less so, and there was nothing he could do to change that. So that was number one. But the second was after the 2010 elections when the Republicans took charge. Their leaders before the election, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, wrote a book called The Young Guns, and they recruited candidates saying, we're going to tear this Obama record down. We're going to repeal Obamacare. We're going to dramatically cut spending. We're going to do this and that. And if you elect a Republican majority, that's what we'll do. And of course, it didn't work out so well. They forgot there's a Democratic president in the White House. He has a veto. But more importantly, they pushed the debt ceiling increase, which is something that is routine, has to be done to preserve the premier status of the U.S. and in the global financial community, and we're quite prepared to live with a public default. I think those two things came together, and we realized that this was not some rump group of activist Republicans, Tea Party supporters that were trying to convince elected Republican officials to move in more dramatic ways. But in fact, those folks out in the country had been encouraged to do this kind of thing as a means of electing Republicans into the majority in the Congress and eventually reclaiming the White House.
Thomas Mann is my guest. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author, along with Norman Ornstein, of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. The book has just been updated and re-released. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes with Thomas Mann.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Margie Evans, nationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with a resident scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley and senior fellow at Brookings, Thomas Mann. His book is called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. It was written with Norman Ornstein and has recently been updated. Tom, when you first published the book, people were startled, not least because, regardless of your personal political ideas, you and Norman Ornstein were both known as scholars devoted to neutrality. Your take is that you're still giving an objective assessment. It just so happens that you objectively find greater fault with contemporary Republican strategy and tactics than Democratic strategy and tactics. Is that accurate?
That's exactly accurate. We don't believe we are demonstrating a bias in favor of Democrats and against Republicans. What we are trying to say, if the reality is asymmetrical in the parties, then to pretend otherwise is to do a real disservice to the public, just reinforcing that it's all a mess, it's all hopeless, everyone's equally to blame, it's the establishment, it's Washington, it's Congress. And I just think that is the message that conveys everywhere, and it's a real problem. Actually, that's the message that makes possible Donald Trump candidacy and some real resonance with it. Remember, Donald Trump was the original birther. He was the guy who said, "Show me your birth certificate, Barack Obama. I think you're Kenyan, not American." And to this day, he refuses to acknowledge any inaccuracy in that. And something like 40% of self-identified Republicans believe either that he's not an American or that they're not sure. He may be, may not be. But that's a stunning piece of evidence. And for that, I mean, there's nothing comparable on the Democratic side. Sure, there are ideological differences within the Democratic Party, certainly differences in approaches, say, between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. But But the sort of the broad objectives are really the same. It really comes down to whether you're a pragmatist and want to get something done, or you're a utopian and want to have an issue to talk about. But on the Republican side, it's really been quite different, and I think the party has nurtured this kind of anger and resentment and belief that you know, the Democrats are the enemy, and that the Congress and the establishment is to blame for all of our problems. And I think it's inaccurate, and I think it fosters really a complacency or misdirected activities that do nothing to alleviate our problems.
All right, I want to talk about Republican resistance to President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. First, let's listen to what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has to say about this.
It is a president's constitutional right to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and it is the Senate's constitutional right to act as a check on a president and withhold its consent. The Senate will continue to observe the Biden rule, so that the American people have a voice in this momentous decision. The American people may well elect a president who decides to nominate Judge Garland for Senate consideration. The next president may also nominate somebody very different.
Okay, that was Mitch McConnell this year. Let's listen now to a clip from then-Senator Joe Biden in 1992 speaking against then-President George H.W. Bush nominating a Supreme Court justice had there been a vacancy. At the time, this was theoretical.
It is my view that if the president goes the way of Presidents Fillmore and Johnson and presses an election year nomination, the Senate Judiciary Committee should seriously consider not scheduling confirmation hearings on the nomination until after the political campaign season is over.
One has to wonder if Joe Biden, who has been known here and there for verbal gaffes in his career, has ever regretted any sentence more.
Probably not. I mean, if he's tried to direct attention of the rest of his speech, when it's clear that he says if the president consults with both Democrats and Republicans and trying to find a nominee who's respected on both sides of the aisle, well, then, of course, we'll do it. But what we don't want to have is sort of encouraging a last-minute nomination and then filling it with someone who has no support on the other side of the aisle. It turns out, as you said, it was a sort of theoretical thing. And in fact, when the opportunity arose in 1988, when Democrats were in the majority and President Bush was in the White House, and there was a vacancy, the Senate dealt with it in the election year and easily passed consented to the nomination of Anthony Kennedy. So the experience is perhaps weighs more heavily than Joe Biden's ruminations in part of that speech. The basic thing here is that when does a president's term end, and when can he no longer fulfill the responsibilities under the Constitution? Is it 6 months before his last year in office? Is it 12 months? Is it maybe 2 years? Maybe he can't do anything in the last 2 years of his term. This is strictly political. The court has become a hotbed of the very ideological polarization that is so evident in the Congress and in the states. And Antonin Scalia was the linchpin of the conservative group within the Supreme Court. He died unexpectedly, and immediately Mitch McConnell, within 24 hours, said, we're not going to consider any nomination. Now, I think he was making a wise sort of political decision. He's worried about holding the majority in the Senate. A number of his Republican colleagues are running for re-election in blue or purple states. They'll be under a lot of pressure. If they have to vote on this nomination, and if they vote against Garland, it will alienate some of their Democratic and independent supporters. If they vote for him, the base may not turn out for him. So they figured the easiest thing is just to say no. Leave it to the next president. Unless, of course, it's Hillary Clinton. And then there's interest in actually confirming Garland in a lame duck session of Congress, because he's I think most of the Republican appointees on the Supreme Court would be happy to have him as a colleague.
Have any of the remaining Republican candidates pledged that if they are elected president and there is a Supreme Court opening in the last year of their term, have they pledged not to nominate?
No. Presidents aren't going to make that kind of preemptive abdication of a constitutional responsibility. You know, the language of the Constitution says the president shall nominate, and with the advice and consent of the Senate, appoint justices of the Supreme Court. The presumption is that that process will go forward. They can hold a hearing and refuse to report it out of committee, or they can send it to the floor, as has happened with other Supreme Court nominations, and let it be decided there. But I really think this is a terrible moment in the history of our constitutional democracy. I understand why McConnell is doing it. On balance, it probably makes political sense for him to do it, but it comes at a great cost to the standing of the court with the country as a whole.
Tom, we use this phrase polarization a lot to refer to American politics. The natural assumption when people hear that term would be to assume that both parties' platforms and ideologies have moved away from the center to roughly equivalent distances from the center. Is this true? Have the Democrats pulled to the left as far as the Republicans overall have moved to the right?
No. That's why our using the language asymmetric polarization is such an important part of our argument. Yes, the coalitions of the parties changed after the Voting Rights Act, the realignment in the South. All those conservative Southern Democrats whose primary issue was race left the Democratic Party. And the South became dominated by Republicans. And the Democratic Party in the South became much smaller and was represented by a lot of minorities, blacks and Hispanics and the like. But in the rest of the party, there was no sign of any ideological change during this period. Democrats had been wild and crazy in the 60s and early 70s, but over a period of time, pushed partly by Bill Clinton and his effort to move the party back to the center, became much more of a center-left party. And the leaders, including most recently Nancy Pelosi, who herself is a liberal, represents one of the most liberal districts in the country, San Francisco, but is the ultimate pragmatist and has actually pulled the sort of diverse factions within the party together. They want to govern. They believe government has a role to play. They're willing to do deals and compromise. But the Republican Party was really quite different. And the many liberal and moderate Republicans who populated the House and the Senate in the 60s and 70s are gone. There's only a handful of them, and they are really lonely and under intense pressure. So you can describe this in many ways. You can follow the platforms of the parties. You can look at voting patterns. You can look at the activist groups surrounding the parties. You can look at the many histories of the Republican Party. E.J. Dionne, a colleague at Brookings, wrote a book called Why the Right Went Wrong and traces that. But there are other books doing that as well. And there's no avoiding the fact that in this case, the polarization that has occurred is not symmetrical. It's not both parties moving. And if we could change the Republican Party, say, back to where they were in the 70s even, this Congress could get business done, even under divided party government. For decades, they managed to do that, but now it's impossible.
We're speaking this hour with Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution and the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. His book is It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. It's just been updated. Back in 2 minutes with Thomas Mann.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution and the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. His newly updated book is called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Tom, I think many people walking around either feel more like moderate conservatives themselves than extremists, or know more moderate conservatives. Is there a place in the Republican Party for folks that don't want a scorched earth policy of politics?
That's an excellent question. There really aren't moderates seeking the presidential nomination. Ironically, Donald Trump, who on some issues like immigration and trade is, you know, the most outrageous. On other things, he's kind of moderate. He believes in Social Security and health care, Medicare, but it comes in such a volatile, dangerous, explosive package. And Donald Trump is the most unpopular leading candidate for a presidential nomination, I think, in the history of our country. I think the party makes it very uncomfortable for the old liberals and moderates, let me say, to feel comfortable in the party. That includes the business community, who are having more and more difficulties. Set aside the Koch brothers' empire and political machine, which is built around fossil fuels and chemicals. Most American corporations believe climate change is real, that it has human causes and that it could have catastrophic results for the world, and would like to deal with it. And in fact, that was quite a popular position for Republicans to take not so many years ago. The same with dealing with the problems of immigration and the like. But I think if you look at surveys and get people to identify sort of their own ideological disposition. Most Americans don't think in strictly ideological terms. They, you know, they have group identities and they take their cue from others. But there is a segment of the Republican Party that is more moderate, maybe 20% in the country or so, but they get the short end of the stick now in the politics of the Republican Party.
It makes perfect sense that for some people, social conservatism, excuse me, and fiscal conservatism work together. It would also seem to make sense that those things don't necessarily align. At what point within the GOP did those two things become equally critical elements of being a party loyalist?
It's really fascinating the way the coalitional elements of the Republican Party were stitched together. I would say it happened in the 1980s. You begin with a sort of anti-government fiscal policy concerns of traditional Republicans. Then you had the effort of the religious conservatives, very active, and they have become the most significant bloc within the Republican Party. And finally, added to that was the international foreign policy side of it, really aggressively interventionist, neoconservative, and you know, this is could be an unwieldy coalition, but leaders provided rhetorical sustenance to the religious conservatives, but didn't do much in the way of delivering to them. The efforts proceeded for them more at the state and local level. But now, as the country becomes more tolerant, more accustomed to same-sex relations, for example, it's putting a strain on the Republican Party. So too is the absolutist libertarian view that all government regulation is a bad thing, and you're getting opposing views to that even, you know, within the business community. So the question becomes whether the current Republican Party can maintain that diverse coalitional base, especially when they've seemingly invested so heavily in alienating the growing section segments of the population. I'm thinking here of the non-white element of certainly longtime African Americans, but now with Latinos and Asian Americans and Islamic Americans, they seem to be driving those people out. They've had a very tough time with the youngest cohort and with those who are really highly educated. So it's not clear they're in a position to be with this coalitional base, whether they can keep it together and compete successfully for the White House. They have structural advantages in the Senate and the House. Two senators per state means California has the same representation as Idaho, and Republicans are helped in that regard. And in congressional districts, the way the population is clustered, Democrats in urban areas together and Republicans more spread out over outer suburbs and rural areas, there's a natural advantage. Democrats won the popular vote for the House in 2002 by about 1.5 million votes, but lost the majority of members and were in the minority. So Republicans have advantages. Gerrymandering adds to that, but is not the primary source of it. And I mean, the most worrisome thing in our politics is that we'll continue with the present. That is to say, will elect Democratic presidents, but will make them work with Republican Congresses. And even though they may over time be more unpopular, most members of the public take out their anger at the party of the president. They don't understand the role played by the other branches. And so we could be in this divided government period for a long time, and that's not going to make anybody in the country happy.
Before I let you go, I see on the TV monitor that I have here in the studio that Speaker Ryan is stepping up to the podium and momentarily is expected to confirm that he has no aspirations to run for the Republican nomination. This seems to be a highly irregular, unusual thing to happen at this stage in a presidential nomination of one party. Why do you think it's necessary, and what will be the result of this announcement that we're expecting from Speaker Ryan?
Well, it's necessary because Republicans have panicked over the possibility of a Donald Trump nomination and a devastating loss in the election. Many are also worried about a Ted Cruz nomination. He is the most despised and disliked among senators, among his colleagues, and his positions are extreme right on almost every issue. So they're worried, and they dream. They say, oh, if they both fall short and there are enough delegates in play, maybe we'll go to a third or a fourth round, and at some point they can change the rules and allow new candidates to come in, and Paul Ryan can do it. And he's, frankly, he may not have meant to, but he's fed some of this by distributing these videos of his speeches and edited just gorgeously. He claims he's working on an agenda for the Republicans in Congress, but lot of speculation about him being the savior. But can you imagine how the supporters of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz would feel if their candidates were pushed aside and delegates came up with someone who never ran? Mind you, it used to happen all the time, and before the primaries became such a central element, we nominated candidates by convention. Democrats had a two-thirds rule. You had to have two-thirds of the delegates, and we sometimes had over 100 rounds of voting before managing to nominate a candidate. But in this world today of small d democracy, I think it would any of those outcomes would not be favorable for the Republican Party.
Thomas Mann is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and resident scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. His book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, was written with Norman Ornstein and published in 2012. They've just updated and re-released the book in light of the political climate today. Tom, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, Chris, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. We really appreciate it. Thanks.